A vision of what, you may be asking. I am. I thought that word was on there earlier, but I guess it didn't translate over. Victory is what you should put on there. That's what we see in Revelation 14, 1-5, is a vision of victory. Go ahead and fill in the blank. It is often that clear promises from God tend to disappear in the clouds of what appear to be contradicting circumstances. And when the promises of God seem to vanish in the clouds of all of those contradicting circumstances, the motivation to remain faithful becomes depleted. When the promises are clouded by contradicting circumstances, perseverance tends to wane. That's why you have to keep a clear vision of future ultimate victory right at the center of your mind. It helps you persevere. You know that. You understand that. You encounter circumstances where you actually begin to question, is this really the way God thinks it has to work out? Where are the promises of God? The circumstances seem to be of such pain, such depth. You start wondering, is this really how it's going to work out? You know what that's like. In fact, the Bible's filled with those kinds of circumstances, isn't it? As you read through it, you see these kinds of circumstances all of the time. You go back to the life of Abraham in the book of Genesis. Abram was promised a son, a land, a nation on that land that would bless all of the other nations of the earth back in Genesis chapter 12. But then he was challenged with a famine that drove him out of that land and a wife that couldn't bear a child and surrounding nations that threatened his very existence. And it seemed like the promise that God made had just vanished. Israel, the nation that was promised to come from Abraham and bring blessing to the earth, survived 400 years of Egyptian captivity and found themselves on the precipice of inheriting a promise made to them almost a millennium before. But when they scouted the land, taking the land seemed hopeless because there were giants in the land. And the promise of God seemed to vanish. And their hearts melted and they didn't want to persevere. You jump into the New Testament and you even see this with Jesus. When Jesus was arrested, where did the disciples go? All the promises that he was predicting as the Messiah seemed to go out the window and they stopped following. When he died, all the hope that the Messiah had come seemed to go out the window. And where were the disciples after his death? Hiding in a room so they wouldn't be found out. Courage, perseverance just seemed to run out the door because the promises were clouded by circumstances that seemed to contradict what God had said. Every one of those examples is eventually resolved because of a vision that each one had of ultimate final victory. Abraham, yes, we see him up and down, and there are times in which he seems to doubt God's promise, but you see the constant upward rise of his faith where he's even willing to give up his only son, the son connected to that promise, and he buys a piece of property. This is so fascinating to me. In Genesis, he buys one piece of property. And what's he going to do with that piece of property? Be buried. He's going to buy one piece of property in the land that God promised, and he's going to be buried there. He knows, I will die and be buried. Why? Well, the book of Hebrews tells us he knew he would be raised from the dead there, and God would fulfill the promise. The vision of the future kept him moving. Caleb and Joshua, the two men out of all the rest of the nation of Israel, these two men said, no, we can cross the Jordan. We can take the land. Giants are not a problem. Haven't you seen what God did in Egypt? And we know where this is going, brothers and sisters. We know how it ends. Let's cross. Those hiding disciples, eventually they see the glorified Christ who just appears in their midst. And by the time he's ascending to heaven, they're told by an angel, do you see him going up in the clouds? How will he come back? In the clouds. And how did the disciples live the rest of their life? Complete abandonment to God. A vision of future ultimate victory is what motivates and fuels perseverance. And that's what we see in Revelation 14. The entire chapter is about ultimate final victory. Not merely a vision of victory for the first century readers of the prophecy of Revelation, not merely for 21st century Christians concerned about growing global opposition, but the whole chapter is a vision of victory that brings the entire Bible to its promised fulfillment. The covenant promises to the nation that would bring saving blessing through the Messiah to all the earth are fulfilled in this chapter. The new covenant promises that the nations would all eventually come in faith through the gospel is found in this chapter. Evil that began in the garden with a serpent, now described as a dragon, and the future final expressions of his rage through the Antichrist and the false prophet and a world system opposed to God is all brought to justice in this chapter. The whole chapter is a vision of ultimate victory. Especially in light of what we've already been studying in chapter 13, which was a vision of defeat and demise, and it seemed to be a contradicting set of world circumstances that threatened everything that God had promised in the Bible. Chapter 14 is the vision that keeps the saints from giving up when they see what's happening in the world dominated by the devil. It's a vision of victory to motivate continued perseverance. So let me give you a little overview of the whole chapter. You can just note it, jot it down if you'd like, but just so that you see it, verses 1 to 5 is a vision of Israel's ultimate salvation. That's what we're going to look at this morning. It's a vision of Israel's ultimate salvation. Verse 6 and 7 is a vision of the nation's ultimate salvation. So just as we see all throughout the Bible, and as we've already seen in the book of Revelation, there's a promise that Israel will be saved, and there's a promise that all the other nations will be saved. And we see that in this chapter. Verse 8 is a vision of the godless, evil world system that is identified here as Babylon, which will be described later in chapters 15 through 18. But it's a vision of the godless, evil world system before Christ's return receiving judgment. Verses 9 to 13 is a vision of the unbelieving people of the world, those who dwell on the earth, finding God's judgment. And then you come to verses 14 through 20, and it's a vision of the Lord actually returning to the earth and finalizing justice. So everything in this chapter is a vision about the end. You say, well, it's a vision about the end. Well, here we are, it's chapter 14, and I'm looking at the rest of Revelation. We've still got a few chapters to go. How is this the end? Well, we've already seen that kind of thing, haven't we, as we've been studying the book of Revelation? Chapter 11 was a depiction of the end and the return of Christ at the blowing of the seventh trumpet of God's judgment. And it culminated with the breaking of seven seals. The seventh seal, it was unleashing those seven trumpets. However, chapter 11 provided no detail about how the world ended. It provided no detail about how the seventh trumpet actually was depicted and finalized. And that began a series of what we've noted are signs, beginning in chapter 12, and it'll go all the way through chapter 20, different signs, or that is biblically rich Old Testament images and portraits that promise what will happen on the earth before the Lord returns. And that's chapters 12 through 20. Where chapters 7 through 11 describe what God would do in his judgment on the earth through the final trumpet judgment. Chapters 12 through 14 show what the world and the devil will do during that same time, culminating in the return of Christ. But as you're going to see, we're going to be introduced to the final evil world system. It'll come up in chapter 14, verse 8, called Babylon. And he just drops that name on us and moves on. You're like, what's Babylon? Where did that come from? Well, as we'll see, you'll see the reaping of the world at the end of chapter 14. But there's, again, little description of how the reaping of the world takes place. How does that take place? Well, that's what chapters 15 through 20 begin to tell us. How will the reaping of the world actually take place? And it's there that we'll see unpacked for us more detail about that evil world system, Babylon, unfold. And it will all culminate with the return of the Lord Jesus in chapter 19 and his reign upon the earth in chapter 20. So that's where we are in the sweep of Revelation. And we begin in the very first part in chapter 14 this morning with the completion of what God actually did promise to Abram all the way back in Genesis chapter 12. Here's the final ultimate salvation of Israel, the nation that would come from him that would bring blessing, saving blessing to all the nations of the earth. Revelation 14, 1 to 5 is a victorious vision of Israel's ultimate salvation. So what comprises that? What comprises Israel's vision of victory? What effect should Israel's victory have on us? That's what we want to ask and answer in this passage this morning. I think the verses that we look at this morning in verses 1 to 5 help us with that. Here's what we'll see. Revelation 14, 1 to 5 contains four scenes. Four different scenes depicting a vision of Israel's ultimate victory. It's their ultimate victory in salvation, and it should fuel perseverance for all the saints. So when you look at what God does for this nation in the remnant that he saves here, in the 144,000, what he does in this moment should fuel perseverance for all the saints. This is the tip of the iceberg of ultimate victory right here. So we'll look at four scenes depicting this vision of Israel's ultimate victory. Let's look at the first in verse 1. Then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion. Let's stop there for a moment. We find that familiar phrase opening this chapter. It is the phrase we find throughout this book because John is seeing a revelation from God. And I looked, I saw. Let's just keep in mind for a moment, John is not merely composing the book of Revelation. He didn't sit down one day and he said, let me see if I can compose a book that would finish up the whole Bible. That's not what he's doing. Now, there are books in the New Testament where a writer like Paul sat down and he began to write a letter to a church, and the Holy Spirit uses every word and moves Paul to choose every word, so that's the Holy Spirit's words, but it's Paul's personality writing a letter. We see that in many letters. Revelation is different. This is not John sitting down to write a letter. This is John receiving a vision from the Lord. This is different. He's receiving dictation from the Lord. Write this down. In another place, he's told, don't write that down. So write this, he's seeing this, and you say, well, there's so much Old Testament that we see here, he must be going back and recording some of the phrases. Well, you would expect that if God is concluding human history and God is concluding the Bible, you would see biblical phrases if he's showing you a biblical vision. And so he does, and he writes that down, and of course it sounds like what you will find in Ezekiel and Daniel and other places, because God is concluding human history here. God is concluding the story here, so he's seeing the vision. Remember, he was in the Spirit on the Lord's day when he received the vision. He's in the Spirit. The Spirit is giving him this, whether by angelic means or the Spirit himself is showing him these things. And he sees it and he writes it down. And he begins with this phrase, and behold. Now, it might be easy for you to rush past that, but you know I'm not going to let you do that. Stop on the beholds. The beholds are vastly important. In fact, we haven't seen John use a behold for a little while. The last time he used a behold was back in chapter 12 when the signs started. Because it was arresting, it was striking. And behold, here's a sign. And now when he comes through all of what we've seen through chapter 13, he comes back and says, and behold, it should arrest your attention. In other words, what you see that John sees in chapter 14 is unexpected in light of what we've been seeing since chapter 12. Because chapter 12 began with the record of Satan chasing Israel and attempting to destroy the Messiah, then destroy the nation that brought the Messiah and the people who follow the Messiah. And we see God during the final 3.5 year period of human history before Christ's return. He protects the nation of Israel from Satan's design. And in his frustration with God's protection, Satan then stands on the sand of the seashore and calls up the beast from the sea and the beast from the earth. The final two expressions of his rage, the Antichrist or the man of lawlessness or Daniel's little horn and the final false prophet that we see, and they come and they dominate the world. The dragon, the Antichrist, the false prophet, the unholy Trinity. And what did we see them do? Well, the whole earth worships the dragon in chapter 13, verse 4. The entire earth worships the beast that comes out of the sea, the Antichrist, in chapter 13, verses 8 and 12. And the beast of the sea actually conquers all the saints in chapter 13, verse 7. That's what the text says. He overcomes the saints for how long? 42 months, and that's as long as he can do it. We're told. But in this period, the entire world believes in a false gospel perpetrated by the false prophet. Together, the false prophet and the Antichrist control commerce and a system identified with a number that reflects loyalty to the beast and the worship of Satan. It appears at the end of chapter 13 that all of the promises that you see for Israel, for the saints, all throughout the Bible, they're done. They're over. They're contradicted. Where's the Messiah? Where's the Lord? Where's the promise going to be fulfilled? Because the whole world's worshiping the dragon. And so I looked, and behold, who did he see? Not a lamb, like the false prophet was a lamb with two horns. Who did he see? And behold, the Lamb. Oh, that's what we needed to see, isn't it? When it looks like everything in the world has fallen apart and the promises of God are done, what do you get? A vision of the Lamb. The Lamb. The Lamb that we first saw in Revelation chapter 5, verse 6. When John says, I saw between the throne with the four living creatures and the elders, a lamb standing as if slain, slaughtered. The slaughtered lamb was standing between the throne and the living creatures. And he had not two horns, a diminished lamb, but seven horns, complete power, absolute power, connected with God in the seventh day and the new heaven, the new earth. Seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God, comprehensive knowledge. He saw the Lamb. And notice, I looked and behold, the Lamb was standing. It's as if he had always been standing there. It's the same thing that we saw in Revelation chapter 5. When the Lamb was first in heaven, it's as if the Lamb had been standing there all the time. That's the sense of the Greek tense. Well, when you get here, the Lamb is now on Mount Zion. It's as if he had been standing there all the time. It's as if victory has been secured. The battle's over. That's not the sense you got at the end of chapter 13. You thought the battle is lost. But here you get to chapter 14 and behold, he's standing there victorious on Mount Zion. We began seeing the Lamb in heaven. But where is he now? Mount Zion. What are we to understand about Mount Zion? Why Mount Zion? Where is this? Some would say, well, this is just another picture. It's like a symbolic picture of him being in heaven. Mount Zion is the heavenly throne of God. I think we can understand this clearly in the way the Bible uses this phrase. Zion is actually referred to 155 times in the Old Testament. That's a lot in my book. 155 times. It begins in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 7, when David, who would receive the covenant in which he would bear the Messiah, David conquered the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. Zion is where? Jerusalem. Jerusalem. But when you read through all of the references to Zion in the Old Testament, you're going to find that Zion is the title that the Old Testament often two refer to the anticipation that God will eventually live with his people, and the epicenter of his rule will be from the city of Jerusalem, and Zion is the name that is given to the anticipated rule of the Messiah on earth. Mount Zion is referred to seven times in the New Testament, and outside the reference in Revelation, it always refers to the return of the Messiah to the earth, namely to Jerusalem, to establish his reign. So if every other use in the book of the New Testament refers to the messianic reign on earth of the Messiah, I would gather that this one does also. When the Old Testament speaks of the Messiah's return to the earth, it depicts Jerusalem or Zion in earthly terms, not heavenly terms. Few references you can jot down. Psalm 48 verse 1. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. Listen to this. In the city of our God, his holy mountain, beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. In the far north, the city of the great king. That's a powerful verse. Because it's a verse that says Mount Zion, in earthly terms, is a city that receives beauty that attracts the whole earth. And it's not the city of just David the king, it's the city of the great king, the messianic king. When Zion is mentioned, it's a picture of the future Zion, Jerusalem, ruled by the Messiah on the earth. To get a better picture of that, turn in your Bible back to the book of Isaiah. I want to spend a moment on this so you see it. The Bible is just not unclear about this. It's very clear. Go back to Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah 11 is about the Messiah. You can't miss it in verse 1, Isaiah 11. Then a shoot, it says, will spring from the stem of Jesse. Who's Jesse? Well, that's David's father. So we're talking about someone who comes from Jesse. This is David. The shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse. But Isaiah's writing this. And Isaiah's anticipating a descendant from Jesse to come, not who has already been. So this is not David himself, but David's son. Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse. A branch from his roots will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. This is the promise of the new covenant, by the way. The coming of the Spirit is the coming of the new covenant. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord will rest on this one who comes from the stem of Jesse. And with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness the afflicted of the earth. Now notice the language here. What is the world going to be like when this shoot that springs from the stem of Jesse comes? What will the earth be like? He'll decide with fairness the afflicted of the earth. He'll strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. And also righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. And the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. And the cow and the bear will graze, and their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The nursing child will play with by the hole of a cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. Sounds like today, doesn't it? No. It depicts a future under the reign of the Messiah where peace rules everything, which is not now. It is not today. It is future. Verse 9. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Then in that day, the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. Where will that be? On his holy mountain. Where is that? Mount Zion. When the Lord comes to Mount Zion, he rules over the earth. The earth comes under his rule, under complete peace. Knowledge of the Lord covers the earth. That's not now. That's the future. Isaiah would go on to say in Isaiah chapter 24, verse 23, He uses language about the end. The moon will be abashed and the sun ashamed. That's language that depicts the end of time and the judgment of God. And when the moon is abashed and the sun is ashamed, what is happening? He says in Isaiah 24:23, "For the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders." When does judgment come? When the Messiah comes back to reign on the earth. And where's the epicenter of his reign? Jerusalem, Mount Zion. One more. Let's turn to the book of Zechariah. Second to last book of the Old Testament, Zechariah chapter 14. And look at verse 1. Zechariah 14, verse 1. "Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you." What's going to happen? "For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle." By the way, Revelation 13, really chapters 11 through 13, have been depicting that very thing. "I'll gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women ravished, and half of the city exiled, but the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. In that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of" where? Jerusalem. It's named and it's even given a geographical location. He's going to come back on the Mount of Olives that faces Jerusalem, the very city that's under the attack by the nations. "And the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half of the mountain will move toward the north and the other half toward the south. And you will flee by the valley of my mountains, for the valley of my mountains will reach to Azel." Yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. "Then the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him. And in that day there will be no light. The luminaries will dwindle, for it will be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor light, but it will come about that at evening time there will be light. And in that day, living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and the other half toward the western sea. And it will be summer as well as in winter." And notice verse 9. "And the Lord will be king over" what? "All the earth. And in that day, the Lord will be the only one and his name the only one." What is that looking toward? Well, it's not now. This is not a description of now. This is a description of the future when he comes back to Jerusalem and he rules over the earth, defeats the nations, the unbelieving nations of the earth, and establishes his kingdom on the earth to reign. Where does it take place? What's the epicenter of his earthly reign? Zion, Jerusalem, the earthly city of Jerusalem. So when we've been describing in chapter 13 the reign of the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth and all the saints are conquered in the last 42 months of human history before the Lord returns, and you immediately come to chapter 14 and I see the slaughtered lamb standing victorious on Mount Zion, what is that depicting? Victory has been accomplished. Victory is accomplished. Could you imagine if you lived in a time when it seemed like every promise made in the Bible was empty? I mean, you have days like that. You have seasons like that where you're like, I don't know that this is what God said. And you start to wonder, is this really worth it? What do you keep your mind on? Not your circumstances. You always fail when you try to persevere with your mind set on your circumstances. You know what the Apostle Paul said? Colossians chapter 3. Set your mind on things above, where Christ is seated. Why? He's coming. He's reigning now, and he's coming to reign on the earth. And what does keeping your mind on things above do? It helps you to persevere now until he comes, because you know how it's going to end. Even if everything looks like it's contradicting what God says will happen, you keep a vision of victory that will be, that is assured to be accomplished. You don't go your own way. You don't find your own path. You don't make your own way through life. You don't contradict his word because you think circumstances are empty of God's promise. You persevere in what he said, even if it looks like it's not working. It's what parents do, right? Like, I'm pouring myself into these kids. We discipline. It's not working. The moment can't be your vision. Ultimate victory is. That's how this vision starts. Everything lost in chapter 13, victory accomplished, chapter 14. There's a second scene that we see at the end of verse 1, showing Israel's ultimate vision of saving victory. Its redemption is completed. Victory is accomplished, but redemption is completed. Where do we see that at the end of verse 1? He's standing on Mount Zion, and who's with him? And with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his father written on their foreheads. 144,000. Who is this? Well, we don't have to wonder who that is. We were told precisely who these 144,000 are. Chapter 7, verse 4. I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed. And where do they come from? From every tribe of who? The sons of Israel. Ah, yes. Just before the final 3.5 years of Daniel's final 7th period of 7 years begins, just before that final, what Jesus calls the Great Tribulation begins, the Lord seals 144,000 from the tribes of the sons of Israel to mark them, to protect them, so that they are preserved throughout that final display of the wrath of God. Chapter 7, where do we see them? In victory, on Mount Zion, with the victorious Lamb in chapter 14, after the completion of that 3.5 years in the reign of the beast and the final false prophet. That remnant from Israel is sealed. They're marked on their foreheads to indicate they belong to God. And you remember, the tribes were actually named in chapter 7 from where these 144,000 come from. All the tribes except a few who were known to be idolatrous. So this is a righteous remnant. And by the way, those tribes that were idolatrous are mentioned by Ezekiel. Eventually, they will be redeemed. But as you begin that final period before the Lord returns, here are 12,000 from the 12 tribes of Israel who are faithful to the Lord, marked by God, preserved by God throughout the final display of Satan's wrath. You say, well, isn't this a vision of the church? Some say this is a vision of the church because they say you get 12 times 12, that would be the Old Testament nations of Israel, 12 times the apostles, that's the New Testament, 12 times 1,000, a perfect number, and that's the 144,000. But that's not what Revelation 7 said, is it? It's not 12 times 12 times 1,000, it's 12,000 from 12 tribes connected to Israel. This is not a reference to the church, it's a reference to Israel as a nation. This is the fulfillment of everything. Hundreds of promises that God made to Israel are now being fulfilled when the Messiah actually returns to the earth. And it's fulfilled beginning with the 144,000. This remnant of Israel who have remained faithful. When Messiah comes back, all those hundreds of promises in the Old Testament, Israel's future redemption will come to pass. We know that, and we know that it's redemption that for Israel that's been finalized, because notice how they're identified. They're the 144,000 having his name and the name of his father written on their foreheads. They had been sealed before the Great Tribulation began, and they were protected throughout, and now they stand with the Lamb like a victorious army, finished without loss, reigning with the Messiah. and they have God's name on their forehead. It's all been finished. Redemption's accomplished. By the way, this will be the reality for all the saints who in the end make it through, and we see the Lord when he comes back and he reigns with us, and even in the eternal state, Revelation 22:4 says, we will see his face and his name will be on their foreheads. You remember, those who follow the Antichrist, they're going to have his name emblazoned on their foreheads or on their right hand. An obvious, personal, public identification with the Antichrist that has social and economic significance. But there are many who would not take his mark. The 144,000 were marked by God in a public, obvious identification that they belong to God, and they have the name of the Lamb, the Redeemer, on their foreheads, and the name of his Father, Yahweh God, on their forehead. So that's a busy forehead. I don't think you should imagine that they have names scrawled there. That's a public identifying mark that everybody can see that these people belong to the Lord alone. And it's a single name. It's not two names. It's the name of the Lamb and the name of his Father. Just like we were baptized in the single name of the Father, Son, and Spirit. It's a single name. Again, attesting to the deity of Christ. They had been sealed, the seal remained, they had been protected. What does that mean? God does not abandon his people with whom he's made a covenant promise. Ever. Ever. If he made a promise to those people, he keeps it. He didn't redefine the covenant because it didn't work out. He keeps it. He keeps his promises. You should hold on to that, friends. If he does this for Israel, will he do it for you? If he keeps his promises, you say, but they've gone astray. They've abandoned the Lord. They're a secular nation today. Right, just like we've seen in the Old Testament, just like we were told they would do. But God has always promised he will be faithful to everyone to whom he makes a promise. He will keep his promise, even if it comes out in the end. You say, well, why are we just focused on Israel? Why just them? Again, this is another testimony to God's faithfulness. And if you need tangible expressions that God is faithful, here's one. He keeps his promise. By the way, the nations will be brought up next in verses 6 and 7 of Revelation 14. So it's not like they're left out. Israel will be saved. The nations will be saved. Which, by the way, is the universal testimony of the entire Old Testament and the New Testament. Israel will be saved. The nations will be saved ultimately when the Lord returns. Redemption is established, it's finalized, it's accomplished. Let's look at a third scene depicting a vision of victory. We find in verses 2-3, worship is realized. Worship is realized. That is, heaven's worship begins to be realized on earth. What happens on earth begins to be celebrated in heaven because heaven is celebrating finality of worship. John says in verse 2, I heard. So he has been seeing, but now he hears. I heard a voice, a singular voice, like one voice, but we're going to see this is a voice that is many, many voices, but it sounds like one voice. A voice from heaven. Now this is different. Where is the Lamb? Where are the 144,000? Mount Zion, on the earth, he sees it. Redemption is accomplished. Victory is established. And then he hears a voice from heaven above. It was like the sound of many waters. We've heard a voice like that before in chapter 1, verse 15, when the glorified Christ was revealing himself to John before he began to write down the revelation. And John says about Jesus, his voice was like the sound of many waters. Here John hears another voice like the sound of many waters. If you've ever heard the ocean roar at its height, that's what he's hearing, the sound of many waters. And it was like the sound of loud thunder that struck outside my bedroom window last night about 1:30. Yours too? Yep. My kids had never heard thunder or seen lightning till we moved here to Missouri. You take it for granted. Some of you were here that first Friday night when I was preaching in view of a call. It was dark, and that window behind me was lighting up with lightning. And you were like, how did you orchestrate that during your sermon? Well, you're thinking it's awesome. My kids are freaked out. And they're hearing thunder. That did not inspire praise in them. Now, David would tell you today, he's like, I sleep better when it's a good thunderstorm going on at night. And I'm like, you have become a Missouri boy. That's for sure. But you know the voice of thunder. When it claps so loud like it strikes beside you, it's deafening, it's arresting. So I hear a voice, like a single voice, like the rush of mighty waters and loud thunder. We'll hear a voice like that in the end as well in Revelation 19:6, when John says, I heard something like the voice of a great multitude and like the sound of many waters and like the sound of mighty peals of thunder saying, Hallelujah, for the Lord our God, the Almighty reigns. He hears it here. You say, well, who is it? Well, it's not the 144,000. They're on Mount Zion. And where does he hear these voices? In heaven. The 144,000 are not the ones singing. They're on earth with the Lamb who has come from heaven to earth. These voices are in heaven. And they're giving deafening praise because the Lamb now stands in victory on the earth and the end has come. And when the end comes, heaven rejoices because the earth is receiving her king. Music gushes forth, instrumental music like thousands of harps playing. That's what it says. And the voice which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. Literally, the Greek text says it's like harpists harping on their harps. Harps not like what Tira plays on Christmas Eve, but harps like that small kithara, like a small guitar, like hundreds, if not thousands of them strumming in unison together. You say, well, who's doing that? Well, we do know that in the original scene in heaven that we saw back in chapter 5, the 24 elders all had kitharas or harps with them that they were playing in heaven. But it's not likely the 24 elders because it says here, they're singing the new song, verse 3, before the throne, that's before God, and before the four living creatures and the elders. So the elders aren't the one doing the playing here, nor are the four living creatures, nor is it God. Nor is it the 144,000 because they're on earth. So who is this? Well, it's very possible that it is what we saw in chapter 5, verse 11, the voice of many angels around the throne and the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands. It could be all of the angelic hosts who have been watching all of redemption play out from the beginning of Genesis and the creation, and they're seeing it come to its finality. What do you think happens in heaven when everything that's been going on throughout redemptive history is finalized? Heaven rejoices in the most profound and loud, deafening praise you could ever imagine. And John's hearing it. And notice how it's described in verse 3. And they sang a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000. That's another indication. The 144,000 weren't singing. They were hearing it sung and they had to learn the song. So someone in heaven is singing it, and they're singing a new song. Well, why is it a new song? Well, that phrase, a new song, is used many times in the Old Testament, like Psalm 40, verse 3. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and trust in the Lord. It's a song about salvation. It's always connected to redemption. Psalm 98, verse 1. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Why? Because he's done wonderful things. His right hand and his holy arm have gained the victory for him. That's about salvation. The new song's always connected to redemption. But oftentimes, the song of redemption, the new song, is not just redemption as we experience it in the here and now, but it's redemption as it will come in the future. Finalized redemption. Psalm 96, verse 1, sing to the Lord a new song, sing to the Lord all the earth. When will all the earth sing the new song in final redemption? Isaiah 42, verse 10, Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing his praise from the end of the earth. When will the end of the earth sing the new song? Final redemption. It's a new song for a new age. It's not a recently written song, and it's not a song that we sing in this age. Have you noticed all of our songs that we sing? We might anticipate the end, but we don't sing because we're in the end. In fact, we were singing a lot of songs. Even the song that our music team wrote that we were singing at the end, it's anticipating, singing about the here and now that we experience here and now, what we see here and now. The new song will be about what we're all experiencing, and that is a new heaven and a new earth with a new name. It'll all be new because we're singing the new song of finalized redemption in the future. And John says, I'm hearing the myriads of likely angels singing the song of redemption, finalized redemption in heaven when they saw the Lamb standing on Mount Zion with the 144,000. Heaven's going to worship. We already know that there's joy in the presence of the Father when one sinner turns, right? It's as if the Lord himself is rejoicing and singing when one sinner turns from his sin to embrace the Lord. What happens when the whole earth is full of the knowledge of God? Can you imagine what heaven will do? What it will sound like? Yeah, he's telling you what it'll sound like. The reality is that at this point, no one could learn the song except the 144,000 because they're the ones who've entered into final victory. It's not all those who dwell on the earth, because all those who dwell on the earth are unbelieving, so they can't learn the song of redemption and final redemption. Heaven rejoices, the 144,000 hear and learn the song because it's now their song. They're realizing what only heaven itself has realized up to this point. Worship becomes realized. You understand what we do every Sunday when we gather here? It's a little taste, such a small taste of what it's going to be like when we're unhindered by sin. And the Lord is present, and his glory is no longer clouded, and our hearts rejoice with a joy that is unspeakable. Worship will be astounding, will it not? It will be absolutely astounding. And every week we come here, we sing, and we sing with zeal, and we sing with vigor, and we sing with focus, and we think about the end, and you hear our voices when Dawson cut out all the instruments, and it's just our voices, and we're hearing the whole church anticipating the final day of the Lord. What's it going to be like when we realize that worship? This is a picture of worship being realized because redemption's been accomplished, finalized. What a vision of victory. Victory is established, redemption is completed, worship is realized. Let's look at a fourth and final scene of Israel's vision of victory. It's found in verses 4-5. Devotion is rewarded. Devotion is rewarded. John goes on to tell us in verse 4, these are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves chaste, or literally as virgins. They are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. What kind of devotion do the 144,000 have to the Lamb? Unreserved devotion. And now it's being rewarded. It's highlighted here. You say, God is rewarding them for their lifestyle? Yes. Well, doesn't that devalue grace? Doesn't that overcome grace? No, not at all. Not at all. Rewards do not nullify grace. Rewards exalt grace. Look, this is a group that was purchased by the Lamb. They didn't purchase themselves. They were purchased by the Lamb. The Lord did this. The Lord purchased them. There's grace. And grace fueled them to live a particularly unique, radical, devoted life to the Lamb. And in the end, when you come to the end of the day, when all of the earth stood against you living that kind of life, and you stand on Mount Zion with the Lamb, and your whole life of devotion is now exalted because God purchased you and you lived for his glory. That's what you're seeing here. The reward doesn't nullify grace, it exalts it. Well, why will this devotion be rewarded in the end? How will it display the Lamb's purchase? Well, let me give you a few thoughts on that. It'll be because of their unique devotion to the Lamb. There's a unique devotion. These are the ones, it says, who have not been defiled with women because they've kept themselves chaste, or literally they've kept themselves as virgins. This is not a statement about marriage. It's not a statement about the goodness of marriage or singleness or the goodness of singleness. It's not saying here that marriage and the marriage union is defiling or somehow singleness equals the truest devotion to the Lord. That's not what he's saying here. We do know that Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7:25, if you're single and devoted to the Lord, you're not necessarily worried by the things of this earth, like having a wife and a family that you have to provide for. You can be uniquely devoted to the Lord. It's not a statement, though, that somehow singleness is a better sanctification. You can uniquely be devoted to the Lord, and that's good and that's right, and those who are single can devote themselves in that way. But this is not a statement that if you're married and you have a wife and you have a family, you're somehow defiled. No, it's they had in this period, the last 42 months, the last 1260 days, the last 3.5 years of human history before the Lord returns when everything is evil, here's 144,000 people who were uniquely devoted to the Lord and that they did not marry and they lived their entire life in a unique display of devotion to Christ. As a witness to Israel of faithfulness to the Lord. It's a unique devotion. It's as if they took a vow and said, here's our devotion and display of faithfulness to the Lord. By the way, this is also, I think, another indication that the 144,000 were from Israel. They were Jewish because if you go back and read Jeremiah chapter 31, which we won't take the time today, if you read Jeremiah 31, you will see this language of Israel being devoted to God as a chaste virgin. That's the language of Jeremiah 31, which is the picture of the new covenant when God restores Israel to her land and gives them a new heart, and they love the Lord with all of their heart. This is the remnant of the Jews finalizing salvation before the Lord, and they had a unique devotion to the Lamb. But also, there will be a reward here because of their radical obedience to the Lamb. There is a radical obedience to the Lamb. They are the ones, the text says, who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. You remember the cloud in the wilderness that led Israel? Wherever the cloud went, Israel went. Wherever the cloud went, didn't matter where it went. Go into the wilderness, that's where we go. Did it go up to the Red Sea? That's where we go. It's like these 144,000, wherever the Lamb goes, they're just radically connected to the Lamb. 144,000 Jewish people, a remnant pointing to the Messiah, pointing an unbelieving nation on the earth at that time to the Lamb, follow the Lamb wherever he goes. No matter what the risk is, no matter what the cost is, they follow the Lamb wherever he goes. It's a radical kind of obedience. The reward is also given because of their unique purpose by the Lamb. They had a unique purpose. Notice the next phrase in verse 4. These have been purchased from among men. They were purchased, they were bought, they were redeemed by the blood of the Lamb as what? First fruits to God and to the Lamb. They were like an offering of praise to God as a first fruits offering. The reward for devotion here doesn't mean that they earned this favor. They were purchased, and he purchased and produced in them a life, and a life that God enabled in them by his grace, but nonetheless, a life that they lived to display themselves as a first fruits kind of offering. What is a first fruits kind of offering? Well, an Israelite in the Old Testament would take at the harvest season what they harvested first and bring an offering from the first of the harvest to the Lord. And they would give it to the Lord. You say, well, what would they live on? On everything that comes in the harvest next. Well, that requires faith. It requires anticipation that God is going to provide more to come. The first fruits was a devotion to the Lord that anticipated more of the same would come. I'm going to be uniquely devoted to the Lord as a sign, as a purpose, saying more are to come. The 144,000 from Israel, uniquely devoted to the Lord as a first fruits offering, saying, more are coming. This fulfills what Paul said would happen in Romans chapter 11, verses 25 and 26, that all Israel eventually will be saved. The 144,000 are first fruits, promising more will come. And we're going to see that in the rest of the book of Revelation. But their purpose, more are coming. Also, we see finally, their reward comes because of their radical faithfulness to the Lamb. Their radical faithfulness to the Lamb. Do you see it in verse 5? And no lie was found in their mouth. They're blameless. You can make an accusation against them, but it won't stick. There's no lie in their mouth. They spoke what is true. They pointed to the truth. They lived according to what is true. There were no lies. There was no flattery. Sincere, faithful speech flowing from their mouths. They were men of integrity. Why? A life of lying is a denial of the Lord. If you live a lie, you deny the Lord because you're ashamed of him. And you think another image that you can't sustain, that you can't keep up with, is an image that you think people will accept you by. So you lie. Not these. These are so radically, uniquely devoted to the Lord. There's no lie. They openly profess the name of Christ. They're not ashamed of him. They live openly before him, and they trust that the Lord will protect them. Liars can't be devoted to the Lamb. People who are ashamed of his name can't be devoted to the Lamb. I think this is another indication, by the way, that God's saving purposes to Israel are going to be fulfilled in the end, because it was predicted by the Old Testament prophets. Just jot down Zephaniah 3:13. The remnant of Israel will do no wrong and tell no lies, nor will a deceitful tongue be found in their mouths. They will feed and lie down with no one to make them tremble. They're blameless. No lies. It's a promise that the remnant of Israel will be men and people of integrity. When the new heaven and the new earth comes, we're reminded in Revelation 21, nothing unclean, no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Outside of the New Jerusalem will be the dogs, the sorcerers, the immoral persons, the murderers, the idolaters, and everyone who loves and practices lying. The new heaven, new earth, it's a place of truth, integrity, blamelessness. A purchased life produces unique, radical devotion to God, a devotion that finds eternal reward. That's what you find here. What are we seeing in Revelation 14, 1 to 5? A vision of victory. Fill in the blank again. It's a vision of victory. Why do we need it? Because the circumstances of life often contradict what God has promised and what keeps you faithful and persevering. A vision of the end. If you try to rely on something else to get you motivated to live for the Lord, other than the coming reign of Christ, it's going to be a temporary motivation, short-lived motivation. It's not going to help you day to day. It's not going to help you month to month, year to year. You concentrate on Christ. Don't you pray that? Weren't we taught to pray that? Your kingdom come. Every day you should be praying and seeking that. Come, Lord Jesus. Every issue you battle, you're dissatisfied in your marriage, with your children, with your parents, with your school, with whatever it is, your work life, you're dissatisfied with it? And so you just want to pick your own way? No. That's not the vision the Lord put in your mind. The vision the Lord put in your mind is there's reward for a blameless life. A life that's been purchased by the Lamb, that's radically devoted to him, will find reward, and you're seeing the first fruits of it right here. Be motivated by that. Let's bow together for prayer. As you are bowed in prayer for a moment, think on your own life and your own life's devotion to the Lord. Are you devoted to the Lord? Is your life found in him? Do you believe in Christ as the one who saves you from your sin and you live your life because you know you've been purchased by his blood? We're about to celebrate the Lord's table. And you'll hear instruction on who should participate, and it's those who've been purchased by the Lord and live for his name. And we're about to display publicly that we wear the name of Christ boldly, honestly, profoundly, joyfully. We wear his name and we represent him. Father, as we approach the Lord's table, and in light of what we've been studying, would you grant us a vision of final victory in Jesus Christ that motivates us to live radical lives of devotion to you, unique lives of devotion to you, no matter what the circumstances say around us. As we